lunch you want to eat, please feel free to join us at the table. I won't feel bad if you stay in the back row, but just know you're warmly welcome to the table. This isn't a formal meeting at all. It's a lunch and learn session.
Representative Hornstein, or Hillstrom.
Portman.
Yes, that too. Sorry, it's been one of those kind of days. I was just informed that we have the floor session at noon. Is that correct?
I don't think so. I think that the Tuesday 9:30 a.m. session got rid of the need for the Wednesday noon session.
So
but
there
I
is
feel
no
confident session that somebody's going to let us know if we're supposed to be on the floor at noon.
Okay.
So yeah. I think we'll just go ahead.
You'll write me a pass for Speaker Thiessen?
Yeah, I'll write you
Thank
a pass.
You.
If we have equal number of Republicans and Democrats, then we can make a pact that we just won't go.
Cool.
Yeah. All right. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dan Wolf from the Public Utilities Commission. And before you, each of you present, just say your name and what you do at the Public Utilities Commission. We are recording this, and we will put it online, and it seems to make sense to me if we let you present, and then we ask questions at the end.
However you'd like to do it.
Thank you.
All right. As the chair said, I'm Dan Wolf. I'm the Assistant Executive Secretary with the Public Utilities Commission. In that role, we can talk about it as we get into the slides, but by law we've got an Executive Secretary, Burl Haar, and then I'm the Assistant Executive Secretary, and part of that portfolio is operations manager overseeing the administrative staff, legislative liaison for the commission, and also communications director for the commission. So it keeps me more than busy enough. As the chair said, we'll be informal, so rather than going through the chair or whatever is a normal commission meeting, we'll just kind of focus this more as a dialogue, I think, would be appropriate. And as instructed, we'll have questions at the end, so let us know. And we've got lots of material, which...
Sorry, our thing is frozen now, so... do I just talk off of the handouts?
Yeah.
Does everybody have a copy of the handouts? There's extras in the back.
So, we'll talk about the commission and what we do. Obviously, we're not going to cover all of that within the 45 minutes or so that we've got allotted here. And I'll mention some of this later on. Than everything just because of the time considerations. So the second slide, or the first substance slide we've got there, major responsibilities of the commission, the things that are most readily apparent to the public in terms of when they're paying the bills. The things that we focus on are establishing the just and reasonable rates in terms of service, and that would be electricity, natural gas, and telecom. Those are the three big areas that are types of service that we regulate would be electricity, natural gas, and telecom. And we do that with different divisions within the staff. We split that up in different ways because there's actually a subset of electricity and natural gas dealing with facilities, but we'll just mention that a little bit later as well. Speaking of facilities, second bullet there, approve energy infrastructure that enhances the public interest. Obviously, that deals with power plants, which have not been an issue for a while in this state, but certainly there's other activity involved in that, transmission lines, wind farm siting, things like that. So establishing that infrastructure. Broad electricity, natural gas, utility, telephone industry policies, resolve party-to-party disputes, because sometimes parties will come to us as well as a major docket decisions. Helping the public, we mediate consumer complaints. It could be a forum for issues discussion, and then represent Minnesota's interest in regional and national forums. I'm sure that you've heard or talked about the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, which is the regional operator for, well, it goes up Manitoba down to New Orleans, South Dakota to Indiana, so it's the middle of the country, and there's a number of regional transmission organizations in the country, and we're in the Mid-Continent one. So there's an organization of MISO states, which are the regulators within that MISO footprint, and there's, as you know, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission at the national level. Are we back on slides? We are. Or no, we're not. Okay. So page three, we've got the structure of the commission. We've got five commissioners, as you know, appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. One of those five commissioners have to live outside the seven-county metro area at the time of their appointment. and that is Commissioner Wergen, and she still lives outside of the metro area. They serve six-year terms that are staggered so that we have one up basically every year. You've got obviously one skip year in there when you've got five commissioners and six-year terms. And so we've got no more than three from one party. We've got three Democrats right now appointed by Governor Dayton, two Republicans from Governor Pawlenty. And as I say, with the skip year, that's why Governor Dayton has three appointments on there so far. Once they are confirmed, they would only be removed for cause, which enhances their independence, and they are full-time positions. I would mention in this regard that the commissioners, in our rules that we've adopted, and under also the statutes in 216A, there's a code of conduct for commissioners, and don't really have time to go into that chapter and verse, but basically they cannot take gifts, as you're all very familiar with. They have a prohibition on ex parte conversations, so that the only way that you could talk to a commissioner about the merits of a proceeding is in a formal process. There's no offline conversations with a commissioner. There's restrictions on their employment after they leave the commission, and all of our decisions are made in an open forum. The open meeting law applies to the commission. So, next slide, or next page, again, talking some more about the commission. As I said, it's independent agency, and we take that, as I'm sure you would like us to, very seriously. We're very rigorous about that. We do have, we're one of the few bodies that has basically all three elements of state government structure within our authority. We act in a quasi-judicial capacity when we make decisions in disputes and contested matters. Quasi-legislative, we will set policies of a broad impact for the utilities and service providers that we regulate. And it's also an executive, as with any agency, because you're dealing with administering programs, you're setting rules through rulemaking process. So we basically have all three government functions within the one agency. Staff of the commission, as I said, there's five commissioners, and then at the staff level, there's 52 staff people, which is, I'll put in a plug, is a very small staff when you look at these things. And we like to think that we're very efficient, and it's not always a perfect metric, but when you look at the number of staff vis-a-vis the population of the state, when you look at it on a per capita basis, our commission ranks 47th in the country in terms of staff per capita. We are the resolver of disputes. We're the ones that make the decisions based on the record, and so there's no advocacy role at the commission. It's always an independent role. That advocacy role is taken on by one button. There you go. Thanks.
I'll be an extra. Yeah.
$250 for that, right? Service call.
She does a fabulous job. She does.
Thank you.
The public advocate in this case is Department of Commerce. They have a couple of different departments over there dealing if it's facilities or if it's actually rates and regulations in the energy field. But they have staff over there that's a public advocate. And so that's that role there. And I said we're independent. For example, our chair does not sit on the governor's cabinet, and that follows through in other ways. I don't go to the governor's legislative liaison meetings, again, so that there's just maintaining that independence and appearance of independence. Commission funding, this is good news for the legislature. We do assess utilities for the costs of the work that we do, and we do have also a fee process that we invoke for permitting facilities. The process basically is with any other state agency, we prepare a proposal, we submit it to MMB, MMB submits it to the governor, but then the legislature ultimately has to approve that. And the reason the legislature approves that is so that we have the authority to spend the money and that we have the funds to spend the money. But it actually is a net zero, almost a net zero cost to the state because all those funds are recovered. In a previous life, in my law practice, I kind of compare what we do to practicing law. When you keep a timesheet, you're only not only keeping your time, but you're also keeping the client, if you will, for who you're working on. And by that, I mean, in this case, the docket, so that the docket, we will put down a docket number, and then our fiscal folks will know who to charge for that work. So that's recovered from that utility. And it's as I said, we need the appropriation to have the authority to spend, but also the money to spend because it's recovered after the fact. Obviously, we don't know what we're going to be working on until we work on it. So it's recovered from the assessments on the utilities in that case. Types of electric utilities in Minnesota. I know this was a question for some folks. They kind of think, well, if you're regulating, you know, electricity, then you're regulating electricity, and that's not necessarily the regulatory scheme in Minnesota. We do have comprehensive authority over the five investor-owned utilities that are operating in Minnesota concerning their retail rates or operations. But in addition to that, there's 45 electric co-ops that provide retail service to their customer slash owners. And then there's also 125 retail municipal utilities. And those, depends upon the city, there might be a utility commission, but ultimately it's up to the city council to make those decisions. So in Minnesota, the co-ops do have the choice of being rate regulated. And we do have one who has made that election in Minnesota, and that's Dakota Electric. And there's a process for co-op members to initiate a vote, and if that threshold is met, then a vote is taken, and if that vote is successful, then they do come under state regulation. But right now, just Dakota Electric has done that. And we do establish exclusive electric service territories for anybody providing retail utility service. More about the types of utilities on the next page. There are wholesale electric cooperatives and municipal power agencies in Minnesota, and they are operating at the wholesale level. They provide transmission and generation to their retail members, who then obviously in turn provide it directly to the customers as a retail service. We do have authority over the renewable energy standards compliance for all of those. In fact, there are, as I said, there's five IOUs in Minnesota, but there are 16, I think it's 16, Jenna, entities that are covered by the renewable energy standards. So the RES is a little more comprehensive than the IOUs. Independent transmission companies, four of the five IOUs are vertically integrated from top to bottom, but Interstate Power and Light has sold its transmission assets to ITC and operates that as a separate function.
Can I ask you, you just said about how many utilities are covered by the RES? And what did you say?
16.
16.
Yep.
Thank you.
Next page, sort of the broad strokes, and Janet's going to get into more specifics on some of the energy regulation issues, but the broad strokes on the statutory framework of our responsibilities, obviously we're protecting the public interest. So we want to provide safe, adequate, reliable electricity and natural gas services at fair and reasonable rates. So it's striking that balance between what is affordable, what's a reasonable rate, but what is a sufficient rate so that the provider can provide reliable service. We evaluate the electric utility compliance, obviously, with the RES, as we were just talking about. We look at their resource plans, and Janet's going to talk a little bit more about that, but that's a planning process where they project what their needs are going to be and then how they meet those needs. We, in terms of the environmental area and externalities, we look at environmental cost values. We set a range for carbon dioxide regulatory costs, and those are some changes in the 2013 session has enhanced that role, but I know Janet will talk about that as well. And then determine the need for large energy facilities and designate sites and routes. And just, again, in broad strokes, two-step process on these large energy facilities that could be again, power plants, it could be wind farms, it could be transmission lines. It's looking at, is it necessary, is it needed, and if it's needed, is it something that's needed by the citizens of the state, where do we put it and under what conditions? And there's obviously a number of major dockets that we're dealing with right now in those regards, particularly with pipelines up in northern Minnesota, but those are open dockets. We'll talk, as I said, more about energy regulation today. Just given the time frame, we'll not really get in a lot into the siting and routing aspects nor the telecom aspects. So, and then I think Janet's going to take it from there. And
okay, thank you, Dan. I'm Janet Gonzalez. I'm the manager of what we're calling our regulatory analysis division. It manages the staff who advises the commission on electricity, natural gas, and telecommunications rates and services. At the moment, we have the facilities issues separate, but this would be all the other major industry segments. I wanted to talk a little bit about, just on the energy side, how the Commission's energy-related responsibilities have evolved over time. Just an interesting factoid that in the statewide regulation of energy services in Minnesota wasn't established until 1974. I believe we're the 48th state to do that on a statewide basis. Now, Minnesota is one of the first states to have a regulatory body back in Railroad Commissioner back in, I believe, 1871, something like that. So I'm one of the first states to start to establish a regulatory body. Telephone regulation came in the 1914-ish time frame. So it's there's a long history of regulation of various industries in Minnesota, but statewide on the energy side came rather late. The statutes that Minnesota has are generally built on other states' statutes that were in other states at the time, so it's not that different in structure to what a lot of other states do. And at that point, it was primarily focused on rate cases or rate setting for natural gas and electric utilities, doing that on a statewide basis, also looking at establishing exclusive service areas and other things. I mean, there were a number of other responsibilities the Commission had, but that was the big focus. In the 1980s and into the 1990s, that was slowly changing somewhat, or at least there were things added. The requirements for utilities to operate conservation improvement programs, which at that time when that started was under the Commission's authority. It later moved to be programmatic authority at the Department of Commerce, although the Commission still has some role in it, which we can get into if you want. But PURPA, which is a Public Utility Regulatory Policy Act, which is a federal statute that allows states some authority to set wholesale rates for qualifying facilities. That came in that time. Resource planning came in the early 90s, and some of the issues on environmental externality. So there was some start to look a little more at conservation renewables in that time. But it's maybe somewhat arbitrary, but I sort of think 2001 as being a fairly seminal date where it started to change quite a bit, and essentially every year, mostly the odd-numbered years, but every year almost since 2001, there have been new authorities and responsibilities added to the Commission that tend to be more into planning and environmental areas. Transmission planning came in to affect the renewable energy standards. The Commission got the authority for siting and routing in 2005, which had previously been with the Environmental Quality Board, had to set the carbon values, and then most recently in the 2013 legislation, a whole myriad of responsibilities, probably the one people think about most are the solar energy standards. So while in the old days we could probably have been labeled rate cases R Us, I think we still have, unfortunately, plenty of rate cases and other kinds of more traditional, if you will, regulatory issues, but we also have much more environmental planning and other types of responsibilities. Looking at the rate setting part of it, which is probably what most people think of, more statute talks about, you know, just and reasonable rates, not unnecessarily preferential or prejudicial or discriminatory, and I won't go into all that, but they're also supposed to encourage conservation and resolve any doubts of reasonableness in favor of the consumer. I mean, that's easy, right? I mean, just doesn't give a lot of real specifics there, but that's certainly the framework in which we operate. And the statute does give some more specifics under 216B16, which is the rate-making statute, the rate case statute, to look at the public's need for adequate, sufficient, reasonable service, utilities' needs for revenue sufficient to meet the cost of furnishing that service. So the main way rates for the investor-owned utility, and again, this does just apply the investor-owned utilities plus Dakota Electric as a regulated co-op, that General rate cases are the main way, which is a comprehensive look at the utilities, revenues, expenses, return. We also have a number of things we call miscellaneous dockets, which are changes that we've determined don't require determination of the overall revenue requirement. There are a number of those, but they would be maybe somebody wants to change the tariff on how it determines the amount of footage for utility connections, things like that. A lot of things that where you don't really need to look at the overall revenues. And there are also a number of rate riders and what's called automatic adjustment, although nothing's really truly automatic, that allow changes for specific types of costs outside of a rate case. And I'll get into those a little more. I mean, on the general rate cases, there are a long list of requirements that are set out in commission rules, some in statute, but mostly in rules that utilities have to file. It's essentially a 10-month process, although it's when you hear utilities talk, it's actually can be longer because we can before commission decision and then after commission decision, there's still process that needs to go on. But it's essentially a 10-month statutory deadline from the date it's filed, unless we extend it for certain reasons. We essentially always send these to the Office of Administrative Hearings for contested case proceeding. Commission sets under statute, the commission's required to set interim rates within 60 days of a general rate case filing. And the concept, sort of a make-whole concept, the idea is that you're supposed to allow the utility to essentially earn a return. It was allowed in the last rate case and make adjustments to do that. If the final rates are higher, if the final rates are lower than the interim rates, the utility has to give a refund. If the final rates are higher than the interim rates, utility doesn't get to, only gets to collect that from the date of the final order forward, not retrospectively.
And the refunds are with interest?
Yes.
As set
by
the commission?
Yep, they are. The Department of Commerce, as we were talking about, intervenes in all rate cases, and they develop a comprehensive review and testimony on major issues. The Attorney General's Office usually intervenes, and there are a lot of others who formally participate, often large customer groups as a Chamber of Commerce or some ad hoc groups of larger customers. More recently, some of the environmental groups have been intervening or participating in rate cases, sometimes representatives of low-income customers. Then there could be specific large customers or specific interests that would relate to a specific utility. And there are really two major things we're trying to decide in a rate case. What revenues does the utility need to be able to provide the safe and adequate and reliable service? And once you've determined that, say they need a certain increase, how should that increase or how should all of the revenues be divvied up among groups of customers? How do you decide who pays what? And then another part of that, once you've kind of decided which group should pay what, how do you structure the rates? Is it all an energy charge, a demand charge, a customer charge? How much is in fixed? How much is in variable? Do you have time of use rates? Do you have interruptible rates? So there are a lot of other, I'll get into that a little more, but they're sort of the two main divisions. And only costs related to providing utility service to Minnesota retail customers are allowed to be included in rates, and we attempt to only include that in rates. There are many categories of costs that are joint and common that need to be allocated or that separated out from the total revenues, the total things you'd see in a report to the SEC or something. Many utilities are diversified. They have regulated and unregulated operations. We would only allow costs related to the regulated operations. That's not as easy as it sounds, because if you have one CEO, how do you decide who the CEO's time gets between regulated and unregulated, and how much of that is Minnesota? You also have wholesale and retail services. Some of the services provided by utilities, or for example, they may provide Minnesota Power, for example, provides wholesale electric service to a number of municipalities in their general service area. who in turn, you know, the municipal utilities, Xcel provides power to municipal utilities, so those aren't collected in the their customer retail rates. And many utilities have multi-state operations. Xcel operates in many states. Ottertail does. So you also have that issue of how do you decide what parts Minnesota, what parts others. And again, given that many costs are joint common costs, there's an office building, there's a power plant. I mean, it's not just simple to decide what criteria you're going to use to decide what part gets into rates and what part doesn't. We also generally use a concept we call a test year, which is an idea of saying, okay, utilities filing for a rate increase, what would a typical, usually future, although, you know, what would a typical year look like? We wouldn't necessarily base it completely on a past year that was particularly warm or particularly cold or had some major storm event or had some other type of thing. You try to get something, what would be an expected kind of cost that would need to be recovered, and they're weather normalized, so you look at it that way. But so we generally call that a test year. Some states only allow you to use, you know, a prior year as your basis. We've always allowed but not required future test years. So Xcel rate case that was filed in November of 2013, for example, is basing rates on what they predict for 2014. Another concept you'll hear is rate base, which is really just what are the investments, the facilities that are used to provide service to the public. And again, usually we don't allow recovery of facilities that aren't already in service, and they have to be used and useful in providing service to Minnesota customers. Then you also look at the expense side, are the expenses used to provide service, were they prudently incurred? And there are a number of things that the statute, which, you know, can go into later if you want, but that the statute specifically allows or disallows. I mean, one of the things it disallows is expenses related to promotional advertising. So if a utility wants to go out and say, please use more and more and more of our product, that doesn't, you know, they can do that, but that doesn't get recovered in rates. Another consideration is what we call rate of return on rate base, which is basically what the investor. Well, what does it cost to finance their investments, which would be debt? A lot of that would be debt or preferred stock, which is not too hard to determine what that cost is. The other part of it is return on equity, which is really what kind of return do you give for the investors? These are investor-owned utilities. They're supposed to be making a profit, but a regulated profit. And another thing that has always been there but is getting a lot more attention lately is the demand and revenue forecasts. Because once you've determined what costs the utility needs to recover, you need to say, well, what would they recover from current rates right now? So you need to say, well, what are customer usage going to be? And that's it's always been somewhat contentious. It's much more contentious now because you could argue that because of the success of conservation programs, because of the economy, the economic circumstances, and more efficient appliances and things that for electric utilities, anyhow, a lot of them will argue their usage per customer is going down, and if their customer base isn't growing a lot, maybe even their demand is going down, or at least it's not growing the way it was. So there are always a lot of arguments over that. You know, what revenues could they expect? So those are all components of just deciding how much money they should get. Then once you've made that easy determination, you look at then how do you collect that? How should the utility collect that money? Often we're trying to look at what we sometimes call a class cost of service study, looking at different groups of customers. There are different ways to break it down, but usually residential, commercial, industrial. There's usually a municipal lighting or pumping category and some others, but basically the three main ones are residential, commercial, and industrial. And you try to look and see who's responsible for what costs, and that's not a lot of that is judgment for the same reasons I said that in determining what the revenue requirement for Minnesota is, because a lot of these are joint and common costs. The same, that even goes more so within a class. I mean, how do you decide who's responsible for Sherco 3? I mean, it's kind of everybody. But you have to have some method of doing that. So there are a lot of methodologies out there that attempt to look at that issue. I won't go into that. And then once you've looked at that, the commission has generally said that's a guide, but given that that's both an art and a science, and in fact, in some ways, I would argue more of an art than a science, although some folks would disagree with that. But at any rate, it's certainly a mixture of the two. And there are other considerations that might go into deciding, okay, how much of the increase goes to which group of customers. There are other factors such as you look at the class cost of service study, you probably look for some continuity in rates. You don't want some sort of huge jump, or sometimes referred to as rate shock.
And I was just add on the class cost of services, as Janet's talking about it, you can tell there's not one class cost of service, there's not one study. Everybody's going to come in with their own different study, and then, how do you kind of arrive at an amalgamation of all of that and come out with what is a reasonable basis for dispensing those costs? So it is a guide, but it's still, you have to work within the other parameters going on there.
Right, that's correct. And once you've decided, okay, let's just say residential customers should get a $10,000 increase. So how do you do that? And you don't have to only look at this in with respect to the increase, but overall, how do you do it? Most electric rates that residential customers experience are two-part. You have a fixed cost of sometimes something called a customer charge or a fixed charge or... And usually that's some attempt to reflect that no matter, even for relatively low-use customers, there's their billing costs, collection costs, meter costs, things that really don't vary with how much energy one uses. But on the other hand, some class cost of service studies would show, $25, $30 fixed charges, which, again, you can argue because it really depends on what you're putting in there. I mean, lots of things are fixed in the short run or not. Nothing's probably fixed in the long run, and where do you go? And right in the long run, we're all dead. So where do you go in between there to decide what's fixed? And the commission has generally not put really high customer charges because there have been arguments for the low, it hits the low-use customers harder. If you had a $30 a month charge, no matter how much you use, it would hit low-use customers harder. It might hit low-income customers harder, although not all low-income customers are necessarily low-use customers, but they may be renters, they may have leaky houses, they may not be able to afford some of the conservation measures. So it's not a perfect correlation, but there's probably some correlation there. It also has been said to be anti-conservation. If you load a lot into the customer charge or the fixed charge, you have lower energy charges and therefore less incentive to conserve. So those are all things to be considered. For commercial and industrial customers, they usually have a demand charge also, at least the larger commercial and all the industrial, which says at what rate are you taking in the power as well as how much are you using. So they generally have a three-part rate. But there are other considerations, too. You can have rates that reflect time of use, time of day, seasonal rates. Also, there are a number. Most utilities offer some sort of interruptible rate for some. Definitely on the gas side. I'm concentrating on the electric here, but on the electric side also, where if customers agree to be interrupted, if you're getting toward a peak, they can get a lower rate or they can get a credit for the time they're interrupted. And we consider a number of things when designing rates: continuity with the past rates, making them relatively easy to understand and administer. I mean, theoretically, you could have demand meters for all residential customers if you wanted to, and maybe with some of the new technology, it would be much easier to do. In the past, it hasn't necessarily. It would be expensive to do. Now, it probably wouldn't be, but do you want to do it? Do you want to do it? The ease of administration and would it really reflect a lot? Effects on conservation, as I mentioned, ability to pay. There are a lot of items that are considered. And then moving away from rate cases a little, another mechanism for allowing certain kinds of changes without a rate case, because most people don't like to go into a year process and can be expensive, time-consuming, and resource-intensive, are things that people some it's called rate riders, automatic adjustments, or a lot of different names that people give them. But they basically are things that allow for changes outside of a general rate case. We've had what we call purchase gas adjustments and fuel adjustments in place in Minnesota for many, many years. The idea back at the time when they were first implemented, natural gas rates were the actual rates that the local distribution company received were federally regulated. That's not really true now, but were federally regulated. So I said, well, they really can't control them. It's kind of allow that to pass on. Sometimes they went up, sometimes they went down. So, I mean, that's good. And with the fuel costs, too, or for the electric side, it's a little different, but that a lot of the costs aren't there's not a lot of control over that by the utility, which, again, is probably not as true anymore. They vary over time. And you know, you don't have to have a rate case to do that. We allow monthly variations and have an annual review. Those have been in place for a long time. Another thing that's been in a place relatively long time are trackers for conservation improvement program costs. And that would be, at the beginning, we allowed tracking it and then recovering it in future rate cases, but allowing a dollar-for-dollar recovery, we pretty soon went to really more of an adjustment type thing. There would be an adjustment on the bill, and they could go up or down. And that was partly as an incentive to the utility to make sure that they could have a more immediate dollar-for-dollar recovery as conservation costs were going up and made it more of an incentive for them to, you know, take the responsibilities on conservation seriously.
Can I ask you to dumb down that explanation?
Sure.
Of Conservation Improvement
sure.
Administration just a little bit more, because I didn't track that.
Sure, sorry. What we have done is, you know, the state has mandated since 1981 with some, and then it's been expanded a lot over the years, that utilities provide to their customers conservation improvement programs. And that was with a certain spending requirement that's at the beginning. Well, there's still a spending requirement. There's also an effectiveness requirement that's been added more recently. But so they had to spend a certain amount on conservation programs. What we've allowed is sort of like an adjustment, sort of similar to fuel costs. A certain amount is built into a rate case. Here's what we expect to spend on conservation for our customers. But to the extent that it's either higher or lower than that, there would be an annual adjustment that the commission would review. There are also included in that some incentives that have been added later, allow them to recover incentives for successful programs. So it's really just a mechanism rather than having to wait for a rate case to reflect higher or lower. I mean, they have been lower at some points in time, but generally conservation expenditures have been going up, both from legislative mandates and commission and department mandates, allow them to recover those. And I guess I think of that as an incentive, or at least a disincentive that utilities could recover those costs quicker. And I think that was the idea when that was implemented a long time ago, that it would give them more incentive to operate their programs. They knew that they would get the recovery of any revenues related to that sooner than they would have otherwise.
So. Okay. Representative Fong.
On that point, relating back to when you discussed that advertising and other expenses weren't considered in what you calculate for getting back. However, these programs, especially with consumers, but also with businesses, there's a great deal of marketing and other expenses involved to get the word out or educate. How is that treated then for reimbursement or being related to an appropriate cost?
Representative, those are included generally in the SIP generally the Conservation Improvement Program adjustment or built into base rates. When I said advertising expense, I was just giving a particular example. It said promotional advertising expenses that are promoting additional use of their product, or advertising expenses that promote a position on legislation for example, are not allowed, but general advertising expenses, I mean safety advertising, programs that are mandated by the government, that advertising is allowed. It's only some narrower exceptions. Since the, for a long time, the only riders or adjustments in effect were fuel clause and SIP adjustments. Since then, the legislature has authorized many, and I could say many, many new categories of riders, especially in the last 10 years. And generally, they are associated with furthering certain policy goals. There are more than 20 different rider mechanisms that could theoretically be used. Nobody's using all of them. The ones that are most prominent are the renewable riders, where again, utilities don't have to wait for a rate case to start recovering costs related to facilities that have been approved for compliance with renewable energy standards or with other government mandates. Transmission riders, which were originally just associated with renewable projects but have been expanded to essentially most large transmission investments, and various environmental improvement riders, both voluntary and ones that are and more recently some that are required, including the mercury investments. So there are quite a lot of those. And then I'm just going to briefly touch on some non-rate issues, but this is part of what I said, that we actually spend quite a lot of time on a number of these. Resource planning, which covers investor-owned utilities and the larger generation transmission cooperatives and municipal power agencies. We generally look at a 5-year action plan and 15-year overall forecasts. The intent is to look at when resource planning was first implemented. I mean, Minnesota was one of the early states to do so, and actually it was by commission rule rather that the legislature later put into statute and expanded to cover co-ops. The commission originally did it just to cover investor-owned. We were one of the early states to do that, and one of the intents was to look at supply-side and demand-side resources equally, which means that utilities traditionally, and I don't think that's true now, but back in the day, traditionally looked more at, from an engineering perspective and a demand perspective, what new facilities do we need to meet our load that we predict? And yeah, maybe there'll be some conservation over here, but that wasn't the main focus of it. And resource planning was mostly to try to say, look, we want to make sure that appropriate levels of conservation are done, and that the results of that are incorporated into how you plan for the future. So it also provides a more transparent and public forum for stakeholders and others to look at what kinds of investments and what kind of decisions utilities might make. We look at whether they're complying with applicable laws. Resource planning has evolved quite a bit to look at renewables. I mean, the legislature has mandated that, and the commission and others have insisted on that also. Get a general understanding of the big picture and helps, and also we're concerned with adequacy of resources, making sure that the utility is going to have enough resources to meet their requirements. The renewable energy standards, which really came into effect sort of in 2001, but more in 2003, and then were significantly amended in 2007 from renewable energy objectives to renewable energy standards in 2007. Those apply, as you were asking Dan about earlier, they apply to investor-owned cooperatives and municipal power agencies. There are 16 entities to whom this applies, and they have certain percentages of their retail sales that are required to be met by renewables. The commission reviews. I don't think I put anything about process in here. But
what's the difference in non-Xcel utilities? What are they?
It would just be anybody except Xcel Energy. So it'd be Minnesota. It would be everybody else. Xcel has. It would be Minnesota Power, Otter Tail Power, Great River Energy, all of the other.
Why do they get
special attention?
Yeah. Well, it's a yeah.
That was a policy decision made by the legislature when the standards were written. There was one set of standards for a utility that owns a nuclear power plant in Minnesota, yep. Xcel. And then the another set of standards that applied to.
It started in 94. I think the differential, in order to let Xcel store the casks at Prairie Island, the legislature said they had to do 10% wind by a certain date. I think it might have been 2010. And so Xcel kind of always had a head start.
Okay.
Right. So the commission reviews this every, we have an annual filing that just talks about making sure that utilities have retired enough renewable energy credits to meet the standard. We have every 2 years, we have a more intensive review of looking at whether utilities are meeting the standards or not. There's also a report every 2 years that's filed with the legislature by the Department of Commerce that we use in our evaluation of that. So you can be seeing that every 2 years. And so far, as of the last time we examined this, all the utilities were on track to meet the standards.
Representative Fong.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you. With this, and since you look at future need and et cetera, what has the data and studies shown is what the minimum required base load for a stable system?
Representative Clinton, I don't think I can answer that. I think it's very dependent on what the makeup of the system is. We're all part of the Mid-Continent area or power pool, which also changes how all that works. I don't know that there's any agreed upon number. I mean, clearly you need some baseload. In other words, some sort of energy that are plants that can be dispatched, that can run 24/7, or at least a combination of them that can run 24/7 and are dispatchable, and that can ramp up and down, that can be dispatched when they're needed. There's obviously a need for that. I don't think I could tell you what if there's some minimum amount that. I think what you're getting at is when you have variable resources. Now, not all renewable resources are necessarily variable, but wind is clearly variable, which is the major resource. And it's not available all the time. It's getting more predictable than it used to be, but certainly not totally predictable either. So you need something you need other types of facilities. You couldn't have something that was all wind unless you had really big batteries, which we may be getting soon, but. So obviously you need some baseload, and solar is going to be a little more predictable than wind. But again, at midnight you don't have a whole lot of solar. Again, unless it's been stored, which is an option. So
you're saying there's no study existing that would give you the basis for determining the required baseload, or that you haven't reviewed anything or used. I mean. If there's something out there, it'd be useful for us to know as we make decisions and prudent so that we can avoid an issue. So if there is a study out there that your organization has looked at, if you could let us know. Otherwise, if there isn't one, I guess I'm a little bit scared of that.
Well, there's a very long answer to your question, right. But I think the tax committee or the property tax committee probably has this room at 12:30, so okay. We should let Janet present her last slide.
All right.
And then I know both of them would be willing to talk to folks in the hallway who have follow-up yep. questions.
Absolutely.
And also, at least Dan probably would be willing to make an appointment to come to your office
sure.
and explain anything in greater
right.
detail.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Dan.
Right.
If you can just
right. go ahead. Right. I'll go one more. Just one thing. There is a study being done right now about what would 40% renewable penetration look like on the system that the Department of Commerce and others are doing. So you will be getting that in a year or so.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And the last slide I have on here is solar energy standards, which were added in the 2013 legislation. They were really added in the same statute as renewable energy standards, but they are over and above on top of those standards, but they apply only to investor-owned utilities and require 1.5% of total retail sales to come from solar photovoltaic by 2020. And certain categories of business customer sales are excluded, and they're exempted from paying. And I guess I'll just leave it at that since we're in trouble.
How often does somebody take a look at this operation and say, we need to change things, or this isn't right?
You mean with regard to the Public Utilities Commission?
Yeah. I mean, does the legislature ever take a look at something they're doing and say, hey, we don't believe that, we need to change it? They're so far removed from the real world.
I don't know if the commissioners would agree with you.
I was going to say, Representative, I think that happens every year.
But
it depends upon what perspective you're asking about. But in terms of setting policy, that's up to the legislature. And we get that direction whenever you pass legislation that affects us. If something needs to go in a different direction than what you think we're adopting as policies, you certainly have that prerogative and have done so in the past to change the policy.
Particularly on the rate making. I mean, you have all kinds of things that are dumped on you that you have to take care of.
Right.
Conservation stuff. Hi, Melissa.
Okay, I got you.
Now I'll get out and hog.
Very good.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.
You get the